That'll be a pretty trick. The scum cover their tracks well.
Brothers of the Sixth are considered the finest woodsmen in the realm, Alhestian said. If the camp can be found, you will find it, I'm sure. He slapped his knee, enlivened by the prospect of some resolution to his dilemma. Thank you, brothers. This plan will do very well. He rose, sweeping a wolf fur from the back of his chair and fastening it over his shoulders. Let's be about it. We have much to do. None of the soldiers seemed to have a family name. They were known mostly by the criminal appellations of their past. Dipper, Red Knife, Fast Hands, and so on. They had chosen the 30 trainees by the simple expedient of making the whole regiment run around the stockade and picking those who dropped last. They stood in 3 ranks of 10, staring balefully at Mackerel as he set out the rules that would govern their lives from here on.
Any man found drunk without permission will be flogged. Those found drunk more than once will be dismissed from the regiment. Any of you shitheads thinking that means a free passage home should know that dismissed men will have to walk out of the Martish on their own 2 feet with no weapons.
Mackerel paused a moment to let the import of his words sink in. A lone man walking through the Martish, with no means of defence, was likely to find himself lashed to a tree and disemboweled in short order.
"Understand this, you miserable bunch of thieving scum," Mackerel growled. "Lord Alhestian has given the Sixth Order leave to train you as we see fit. You belong to us now." "Didn't sign up for this," a sallow-faced man in the front row muttered sullenly. "Supposed to be in the King's service."
Mackerel's fist smashed into the man's jaw, felling him instantly.
"Brother Barkus," he barked, stepping over the prostrate soldier. 10 lashes for this man, no rum for a week."
He glared at the remaining trainees.
"Anyone else want to discuss their terms of service?"
Canis and Dento slipped into the forest the next day with instructions to find the Cumbralians' camp whilst the men were trained. The combined threat of flogging and death proved an excellent stimulus to both discipline and exertion. Their trainees scrambled to obey every order, running for miles through the snow, enduring bruising lessons in swordsmanship or unarmed combat, listening in respectful silence as Mackerel attempted to teach them the basics of woodcraft. If anything, they seemed too respectful, too cowed by fear, and Valen knew fearful soldiers made bad soldiers.
"Don't fret it," Mackerel told him. "As long as they're more scared of us than they are of the scum, they'll do fine."
Valen took charge of the sword lessons, whilst Barkus made himself a figure of dread with his rough-and-tumble approach to unarmed combat. Norta quickly abandoned attempts to teach the men the bow. None of them had the muscle or the skill for it, and concentrated instead on the crossbow, a weapon even the clumsiest oaf could master in a few days. By the end of the first week, their small company could run 5 miles without complaint, had lost their fear of sleeping outside the stockade, and most could hit a mark at 20 paces with a crossbow. Their sword skills and basic fighting ability were still lacking, but Valen felt they had at least learned enough to survive an initial encounter with Black Arrow's men. As usual, Valen's legend had preceded him, and the men regarded him with a mixture of awe and fear. They would occasionally exchange a word or two with Norta and Barkus, but maintained a rigid silence in Valen's presence, as if one wrong word could earn a swift death. Their fear was deepened by Valen's black mood, making him short-tempered and prone to dishing out painful slaps with the wooden stave he used for sword practice. At times he found himself sounding like Master Solis. It did nothing to lighten his mood. Alhestian had chosen to train with the men, running with them and sharing their bruises in practice. He proved a skilled swordsman, and was sufficiently tall and strong to at least compete with Barkus in unarmed combat. All the while he strove to encourage the men, dragging slackers to their feet and pulling them along during the runs, applauding their meager progress with the sword. Valen noticed their growing regard for the young noble, where before he had been that snot-nosed lackwit behind his back. Now he was simply his lordship. The mood of the men was still sullen. They had no affection for Valen and his brothers, but Alhestian had become a figure worthy of their solidarity. Watching him as he sparred with some of the men, Valen felt his depression deepen yet further.
"Murderer."
The voice had begun to plague him, the day they began the training. A soft, knowing murmur at the back of his thoughts, whispering awful truths.
Assassin, you're no better than the scum who killed Mikkel. The king has made you his creature.
What do you think, brother?
Alhestian was striding towards him through the snow, face flushed with exertion, but also bright with optimism.
Will they do?
At least another 10 days, my lord, Velen replied. They still have much to learn.
But they have improved greatly, wouldn't you say? At least now we can call them soldiers.
Fodder, more like. A mask for your deceit, bait for your trap.
Indeed, my lord.
Pity Brother Yalin didn't live to see this, eh? Brother Yalin had been the Fourth Order's addition to their expedition. Nominally responsible for reporting their progress to Aspect Tendris, he had spent the first weeks in the forest claiming he couldn't venture outside the stockade because his attempts to teach the men the Catechism of Devotion were of primary importance. Sadly, he soon succumbed to a virulent bout of dysentery and died shortly after. It was fair to say he hadn't been greatly missed.
It seems odd that Aspect Tendris didn't send a replacement for Brother Yalin,
Valen commented.
Alhestian shrugged. Perhaps he thought the journey too perilous.
Perhaps. Or he could be in complete ignorance of Brother Yalin's death. One might almost think someone has been sending Aspect Tendris regular reports in Brother Yalin's name.
Such a thing would be unthinkable, brother.
Alhestian laughed and went off to shout encouragement at a group of men grappling nearby.
Why couldn't you have been hateful? Valen wondered. Why couldn't you have made my task easy?
The voice's response was immediate, implacable. Should murder ever be easy?
Chapter 2
About 70 men, all told, Dento said around a mouthful of salt beef. 10 miles west of here. It's a well-chosen site, a gully to the east. Rocks to the south and a steep slope to the north and west. Hard to take unawares.
They had returned on the 14th day of their training, Canis bearing a sketched map showing the layout of the Cumbrelians' camp. They huddled around the campfire with Alhestian and Mackerel to plan the attack.
70's a lot for these lads to face, brother,
Barkus advised Mackerel.
Even with our brothers, they'll still have numbers in their favour.
Each brother's worth at least 3 of theirs, Mackerel replied.
Besides, a surprised man is usually defeated before he even draws his sword.
He paused to ponder Canis's map, tracing a stubby finger over the gully leading to the camp's eastern edge.
How well do they guard this?
3 men during the day, Canis replied. 5 at night. Black Arrow is a cautious man, it seems. Knows we're most likely to come for him in darkness.
There is a route in.
He pointed to the cluster of rocks covering the camp's southern border. I got close enough to smell their pipe smoke. But it's a path for one man only. Any more would be seen.
5 men guarding the best way in, and only 1 man to open the door?
Mackerel mused.
That's if you can get across the camp unseen.
We've kept some of their clothing and weapons, Valen said.
In the dark, they might take me for one of their own.
You mean me, brother, Canis said.
5 men at once.
As Brother Mackerel says. Surprised men are easier to kill. Besides, I'm the only one who knows the way.
He's right, Mackerel said. I'll take our brothers through the gully.
My lord,
he glanced at Alhestian.
I suggest you take your company to the southern approach. Wait until you hear the clamor of our attack, then charge straight in. We'll have drawn most of their strength to us, so you should catch them on their blind side.
Alhestian nodded.
A good plan, brother.
I should go with Lord Alhestian, Valen said. The men may be less inclined to tarry in the charge if one of us is with them. He could tell from Mackerel's narrowed eyes that his suspicion still lingered.
He knows, the voice hissed in his mind.
The others would never suspect, but he knows.
He smells it on you like blood.
It'd be better if Sendarl and Jeshua went with his lordship, Mackerel said, his narrow gaze still fixed on Valen.
Your sword will be much needed when we breach the camp.
They're more afraid of Valen than they are any of us, Barkus commented.
Lot less likely to run if he's with them.
And I would be honored to fight at Brother Valen's side,
Alhestian enthused.
I believe it's a fine idea.
Mackerel slowly returned his gaze to the map.
As you wish, my lord.
He pointed at the slope north of the camp. If this goes right, they'll flee down the hill towards the river. The perfect place to trap them. If the departed favor us, we should get them all. He looked up, his expression suddenly fierce. Even so, this'll be a hard and bloody fight. The scum don't ask for quarter, and won't give any. Tell the men to get close, use their swords. Don't give them a chance to get their bows into play. Make sure they know defeat will mean death for all of us. There's no retreat from this place. We kill them all, or they'll be sure to kill us. He rolled the map into a scroll and got to his feet. 5 hours sleep, then we move out. We'll march in the dark so their scouts won't see us. 10 miles is a lot of ground to cover in the snow, so we'll have to press hard. Any man who talks without permission or falls out on the march will have his throat slit. No rum ration until this is done. He tossed the map to Canis. Brother, you'll lead the way. The march was hard, taxing the men to the extreme, but the promise of death for any too exhausted to continue was sufficient to keep them moving. The order was at the head of the column, arrows notched to their bowstrings, eyes peering into the dark for any sign of Cumbrelian scouts. Although Black Arrow's men sometimes came to harass the camp at night, with a fire arrow launched over the stockade, their visits had trailed off when Canis and Mackerel had taken to hunting after sundown, collecting 4 bows in as many nights. Now the Cumbrelians rarely ventured close at night, and their march was not interrupted. It took 8 hours of hard going before they came to the edge of a clearing, where a small slope led up to the mound of rocks behind which the Cumbrelians had made their camp. Off to the right, they could glimpse the dark shadow of the gully where Mackerel would lead the order contingent. There was little preamble. Mackerel made the sign of good luck, and led the 18 brothers off across the clearing in a loose skirmish formation. "Need anything?" Velin signed to Canis. His brother shook his head, pulling a cord tight on his sable-pelted jerkin. In his captured garments he fitted his role well, the disguise completed by exchanging his strongbow for a longbow and hitching a hatchet into his belt. He opted to keep his sword strapped to his back. Their enemies had captured many Asrenian blades from Alhestian soldiers, so it was unlikely to look out of place. "Luck to you, brother," Velin signed, touching his shoulder. Canis grinned briefly and was gone, covering the distance to the rocks in a dead run. "He'll be fine," Velin reassured himself. Their time in the Martish had given him a new appreciation of Canis's skills. The slight boy who had shivered in fear at Master Greelin's tall tales of monstrous rats was now a lithe, deadly warrior, who seemed to fear nothing and killed without hesitation. There was a crunch of snow as Alhestian crouched beside him. "How long do you think, brother?" he whispered. Velin fought down a surge of guilt at the sight of the young noble's earnest face. "You hope he won't realize it was you," his ever-present watcher told him. "You hope he'll go into the beyond believing the lie that you were friends." "An hour or so, my lord," he whispered back. "Perhaps less. It'll give the men a chance to rest, at least." He moved away to check on his soldiers, murmuring reassurance and encouragement. Velin tried not to listen, and concentrated on the dim silhouette of the rocks. The sky was still dark, but had taken on the blue tinge heralding the onset of daylight. Mackerel had favored a dawn attack, when the guards at the mouth of the gully would be tiring at the end of their shift. Velin studied his breathing, counting the passing seconds, gauging the right moment to set his scheme into motion, forcing away any thought that might deflect him from his course. His hand ached as his grip tightened on his bow. When he was sure at least half an hour had passed, he moved to Alhestian, crouching to whisper in his ear. "There are sure to be guards in the rocks," he said. "My brother will have let them be to avoid raising the alarm, although there won't be enough of them to stop our attack. Their bows are likely to thin our ranks." He hefted his bow. "I'll go ahead now. When the attack starts, I'll make sure they don't trouble us." Alhestian rose. "I'll come with you." Velin restrained him with a firm grasp on his forearm. "You must lead the men, my lord." Alhestian cast a glance round at the tense, drawn faces of his men and nodded reluctantly. "Of course." Velin forced a smile. "We'll share breakfast in Black Arrow's tent." "Liar." "Luck go with you, brother." He found he couldn't meet Alhestian's eye, nodding and setting off for the rocks at a run, covering the ground in what seemed like a few heartbeats, sheltering amidst the huge boulders that rose out of the snow like slumbering monsters. He cast a quick eye around for any sentries, but saw nothing. From the camp came the faint scent of wood smoke, but no sound of any alarm. Canis had yet to move against the guards at the gully. Velin reached for his quiver and extracted a cloth-wrapped arrow, discarding the covering to reveal an ash-black shaft and raven fletching, a Cumbrelian arrow taken from the archer who had slain poor Lord Al-Jelnik, his instrument of murder. A single arrow would claim Lord Alhestian's life, as he heroically led his men in a charge against an enemy encampment. "A fine end indeed," the voice said. "His father will be proud, I'm sure. Remember your words? Remember your vow? I'll kill, but I won't murder."
"Leave me be," Velin spat back. "I do what I must. There is no choice in this. I cannot break a contract with the king."
His hands shook as he notched the arrow to the string, his heart a booming drum in his chest.
"Enough." He flexed his hands, forcing the tremor away. "I do what I must. I've killed before. What's one more death?"
From behind him came a faint clash of metal on metal, followed by the snap of bowstrings and a sudden clamor of alarmed voices. The sounds of battle were soon echoing across the clearing, and Velin saw Alhestian's command emerge from the trees and begin their charge. The young noble was easy to pick out, leading his men by a good few strides, long sword held high, his cloak trailing. Velin could hear his calls to the men, urging them forward. He was strangely gratified to see that the whole company had followed Alhestian, having expected many to flee. He dragged in a deep draught of air, the chill burning his lungs, and raised his bow. Drawing the string back, the raven's feathers in the shaft caressing his cheek, the beads centered on Alhestian's rapidly approaching form. Murder is easy, he realized, the string slipping over his fingers, like snuffing out a candle. Something growled in the darkness. Something shifted its weight and scraped at the snow. Something made the hairs on the back of his head prickle. The familiar sense of wrongness built within him like a fire, the tremor returning to his hands as he lowered the bow and turned. The wolf's teeth were bared in a snarl, its eyes bright in the gloom, raised hackles like spikes of silver. As their eyes met, its growl subsided, and it raised itself from the aggressive crouch it had assumed, regarding him with the same silent intensity he remembered from the test of the run all those years ago. The moment seemed to stretch, Velin captured by the animal's gaze, unable to move, a thought singing in his mind. "What am I doing? I am no murderer." The wolf blinked and turned, sprinting away across the snow, a blur of silver and frost, gone in a heartbeat. The approaching shouts of Alhestian's charging men brought him back to his senses, turning to see they were almost at the rocks. Less than 20 feet away, a figure rose, garbed in sable, a drawn longbow aiming a shaft straight at Alhestian's chest. Velin's arrow took the archer in the belly. He was on him in seconds, his long-bladed dagger stabbing down to make sure of the kill. "My thanks, brother," Alhestian called, leaping past to charge onto the camp. Velin surged after him, tossing his bow aside and drawing his sword. The camp was a chaos of death and flame. The Cumbrelians could equal the order's bow skills, but at close quarters they were hopelessly outmatched. Bodies littered the snow amidst burning tents. A wounded Cumbrelian stumbled out of the smoke, a bloodied arm hanging useless at his side, his good limb swinging a hatchet wildly at Alhestian. The noble easily sidestepped the blow and hacked the man down with his long sword. Another came at Velin, eyes wide with panic and fear, jabbing a long-bladed boar spear at his chest. Velin ducked under the weapon, grasping the haft below the blade and pulling its owner onto his sword. One of Alhestian's soldiers charged forward and rammed his sword into the Cumbrelian's chest, his scream of exultant fury merging with the shouts of the other men as they followed Alhestian onwards, killing all they could find. Velin saw Alhestian charge off into the smoke and followed, seeing him cut down 2 men in quick succession. A third leapt onto his back, wrapping his legs around the noble's chest, dagger raised high. Velen's throwing knife took the Cumbrellan in the back, Alhestian shrugging him off as he convulsed in pain, the long sword slashing down to cleave his chest. Alhestian raised his sword in a silent gesture of thanks and ran on. The bloodshed became frenzied as the company killed their way through the camp, hacking down the few Cumbrellans still able to offer resistance or knifing those found lying wounded. Velen ran past a series of nightmarish tableaux. A soldier raising the severed head of a Cumbrellan to let the blood bathe his face. Three men taking turns to slash at a man, writhing on the ground. Men laughing at a Cumbrellan as he tried to stuff his guts back into the hole in his belly. He had seen men drunk before, but never on blood. After months of fear and misery, Alhestian's soldiers were taking full measure of retribution from their tormentors. He caught up with Alhestian, finding the noble standing uncertainly over the kneeling figure of a young Cumbrellan, a boy of no more than 15 years. The boy's eyes were closed, his lips moving in a murmured prayer. His weapons lay at his side, and his hands were clasped in front of his chest. Velen paused, catching his breath and wiping blood from his sword. From the direction of the river he could hear the clamor of weapons and shouts of combat as his brothers finished the last of Black Arrow's men. Dawn was rising fast now, revealing the horrid spectacle of the camp. Bodies lay all around, some still twitching or writhing in pain, streaks of blood discoloring the snow between the blazing tents. Alhestian's men wandered through the destruction, looting the dead and finishing off the wounded. "What should we do with him?" Alhestian said. His face was streaked with sweat and ash, his expression grim. The bloodlust evident in his men had not reached him. He did not relish the killing. Velen was very glad he had abandoned his bargain with the king. "He will be angry," his watcher told him. "I'll answer to the king," he replied. "He can have my life if he wants it. At least I won't die a murderer." Velen glanced at the boy. He seemed oblivious to their words or the sounds of death around him, intent on his prayer. He spoke a language Velen didn't know, the prayer flowing from his lips in a soft, almost melodious tone. Was he asking his god to accept his soul, or deliver him from impending death? "It seems we have our first prisoner, my lord." He nudged the boy with his boot. "Stand up, and stop yammering." The boy ignored him, his expression unchanged as he continued to pray. "I said, get up!" Velen reached down to grab the boy's pelt. There was a rush of air on his neck as something flicked past his ear, followed by the hard smack of an arrow finding flesh. He looked up to see Alhestian staring at the black shaft buried in his shoulder, his eyebrows raised in a faint expression of surprise. "Faith!" he breathed and collapsed heavily to the snow, his limbs already twitching as the poison mingled with his blood. Velen whirled, catching a blur of powdered snow in a nearby cluster of trees. Rage filled him then, sprinting in pursuit of the archer, with red mist clouding his vision. "You there!" he called to a group of soldiers. "See to his lordship, he needs a healer!" He ran full pelt into the trees, all senses alive to the song of the forest, searching, hunting. There was a faint crunch of snow off to the left, and he sprinted after it, his nostrils finding the scent of fear-born sweat. He had never been so alive to the song of the forest before, never so possessed by the desire to kill. His mouth was flooded with drool, and his mind devoid of all thought but the need for blood. How long he hunted would always be lost to him. It was a dream of blurred trees and half-remembered scents, as his quarry led him deeper into the forest. He ran tirelessly, immune to any strain. He knew only the hunt and the prey. The song of the forest changed as he entered a small clearing. The birdsong greeting the dawn was muted here, stilled by an unwelcome presence. He stopped, fighting to control his heaving chest, searching with all his senses, straining for the faintest sign. The clearing was well lit by the rising sun, the sunlight playing over an oddly shaped stone in its center. Something about the stone drew his attention, lessening his concentration on the forest's song. It stood about 4 feet in height, with a narrow base, rising to a wide flat top in a roughly mushroomed shape, part overgrown with creepers. Looking closer, he realized it was not a natural feature at all. but fashioned, chiseled from one of the many granite boulders that littered the Martish. If his senses hadn't been so alive, he would have missed the faint creak of the bowstring. He ducked, the arrow passing over his head in a black streak. The archer leapt from the bushes, hatchet raised high, his war cry shrill and savage. Valin's sword slashed into the man's wrist, his hatchet spinning away along with the hand that held it, the backswing laying his throat open as he staggered back in shock. He took only seconds to bleed to death. Valin sagged as his body woke to the end of the hunt, the ache of the battle, and the chase seeping into his limbs, his pulse raging in his ears as he fought for breath. He stumbled away, slumping against the stones, sinking to the ground, wanting nothing more than sleep. His eyes were drawn to the archer's corpse, the lines and weathering on his slack features betraying him as a man with more years than most of their enemies. Black arrow? Valin wondered, but found he was too tired to search the body for any evidence of the man's identity. The song of the forest returned as he lay there, head sagging to his chest, the bird's song louder now. A sudden warmth in his limbs roused him, and he looked up to find the clearing bathed in bright sunlight. Oddly, the sun was now high overhead, and he realized he must have surrendered to sleep.
Fool!
He climbed to his feet, making to brush the snow from his cloak. Except there was none. No snow on his cloak, or his boots. No snow on the ground or the trees. Instead, the ground was covered in lush green grass, and the trees were liberally adorned with leaves. The air had lost the sharp chill of winter, and through the forest canopy, the sky was a deep shade of blue. Summer. It's summer. He looked around wildly. Black Arrow's body, if it was indeed his, was gone. The stone structure that had drawn his gaze when he first entered the clearing was now bare of foliage, revealing a finely carved plinth of grey granite, its top perfectly flat save for a circular indentation in the centre. He moved closer, reaching out to trace a finger along the surface.
You shouldn't touch that.
He whirled, leveling his sword at the source of the voice. The woman was of medium height and dressed in a simple robe of loosely woven fabric, the design of which was completely unfamiliar. Her hair was black and long, tumbling over her shoulders and framing an angular, pale-skinned face. But it was her eyes that fixed him, or rather the fact that she had no eyes. They were a milky pink in color, devoid of pupils. As she neared, he saw they were shot through with a fine web of veins, like two orbs of red marble, regarding him above a faint smile. Blind? But how could she be? He could tell she was seeing him. She had seen him reach out to the stone. Something about the set of her features triggered a memory from a few years ago, a grave, hawk-faced man shaking his head sadly and speaking in a language Valin didn't know. Sorda, he said. You're of the Sword Asil. Her smile widened a little. Yes. And you're Beryl Shak'ur of the Merilim Sil. She raised her arms, encompassing the clearing. And this is the place and time of our meeting.
My name is Valin Al-Sorna, he said, mystification making him stumble over the words. I am a brother of the Sixth Order.
Really? What's that? He stared at her. The Sorda were renowned for their insularity, but then how could she know his language, but not know of the Order?
I'm a warrior in service to the faith, he explained.
Oh, you're still doing that. She came closer, her brows furrowed, head angled, red marble eyes regarding him for a moment of unblinking scrutiny.
Ah, still so young.
I always assumed you would be older when we met. There is still so much for you to do, Beryl Shak'ur. I wish I could tell you it will be an easy road.
You speak riddles, lady. He glanced around at the impossible summer day. This is a dream. A phantom in my mind. There are no dreams in this place.
She moved past him, reaching out to the stone plinth, her hand hovering over the circular indentation in the center. Here there is only time and memory. Trapped in this stone until the ages turn it to dust.
Who are you? He demanded. What do you want of me? Did you bring me here?
You brought yourself, She withdrew her hand and turned back to him. As for who I am, my name is Nersa Silnin, and I want many things, none of which you can give me. He realized he was still holding his sword and sheathed it, feeling faintly foolish. The man I killed, where is he? You killed a man here? She closed her eyes, and a note of sadness colored her voice. How weak have we become? I had hoped I was wrong, that my sight had failed me. But if blood can be spilled here, then it has all happened. She opened her eyes again. My people are scattered, are they not? They hide in the forests whilst you hunt them to extinction. You do not know of your own people? Please, tell me. The Sora Sil dwell in the great northern forest. My people do not go there. We do not hunt the Sora. 'Tis said they are greatly feared, even more than the Lonak. Lonak? So they survived the coming of your kind. I should have known the High Priestess would find a way. She turned her blank gaze on him once more. The impression of scrutiny was overpowering, his sense of wrongness flaring with it. But the sensation was different this time, not so much a warning of danger, more a feeling of disorientation, as if he had climbed a cliff and found himself awed by the sight of the ground far below. So, said Nersa Silnin, her head tilted, you can hear the song of your blood. My blood? The feeling you just experienced. You have felt it before, yes? Several times. Mostly in times of danger. It has saved me in the past. Then you are fortunate to be so gifted. Gifted? He didn't like the tone she used when speaking the word. There was a gravity to it that made him uncomfortable. It is simply an instinct for survival. All men have it, I'm sure. All men do. But not all can hear it as clearly as you can. And the blood song has more to its music than simply a warning of danger. In time, you'll learn its tune well enough. Blood song. You're saying I'm afflicted with the dark somehow? Her mouth twitched in faint amusement. The dark? Ah, yes. The name your people will give to what they fear and refuse to understand. The blood song can be dark, Beryl Shakur. But it can also shine very brightly indeed. Beryl Shakur. Why do you call me that? I have a name of my own. Men such as yourself tend to collect names like trophies. Not all the names you'll earn will be so kind. What does it mean? My people believe the raven to be a harbinger of change. When the raven's shadow sweeps across your heart, your life will change, for good or ill. There is no way to know. Our word for raven is Beryl, and our word for shadow is Shak. And you, Valin Al-Sorna, warrior in service to the faith, are the shadow of the raven. The sensation, the blood song, she called it, was still singing in him. It was stronger now. The feeling was not unpleasant, but it did make him wary. And your name? I am the song of the wind. My people believe that the wind can carry the voices of the departed from the beyond. Then your people know more than I gave them credit for. This, Valin gestured around him at the clearing, this is the past, isn't it? In a way, it is my memory of this place trapped in the stone. I trapped it there because I knew one day you would come and touch the stone, and we would meet. How long ago is this? Many, many summers before your time. This land belongs to the Sora Sil and the Lonak. Soon your people, the Marilim Sil, the children of the sea, will come to our shores and take it all from us, and back to the forest we will go. I have seen it. The blood song is your gift, but mine is the sight that can pierce time. Only when I use my gift can my eyes see. It is the price I pay. You're using your gift now? I am... He fumbled for the right word. A vision? In a way. It was necessary that we meet. And now we have. She turned and began to walk back to the trees. Wait. He reached out to her, but his hand grasped nothing, passing through her robe like mist. He stared at it in bewilderment, This is my memory, not yours, Nursa Silnin told him without pausing. You have no power here.
Why was it necessary for us to meet?
The blood song had raised its pitch now, forcing the questions from his lips.
What was your purpose in calling me here?
She walked to the edge of the clearing and turned, her expression somber but not unkind. You needed to know your name.
Valin!
He blinked, and it was all gone, the sun, the lush grass beneath his boots, Nursa Silnin and her maddening riddles, gone. The air felt shockingly cold after the warmth of that summer's day, uncountable years ago. The whiteness of the snow making him shield his eyes.
Valin?
It was Norta standing over him, his face a mixture of bemusement and worry.
Are you hurt?
He was still slumped against the plinth, now once again covered in weeds.
I needed to rest.
He accepted Norta's hand and hauled himself upright. Nearby, Barkus was rifling the corpse of the old archer Valin had killed.
You tracked me here?
He asked Norta.
It wasn't easy without Canis. You don't leave much of a trail.
Canis is hurt. He earned a cut on the arm when he took care of the sentries. It's not too bad, but he's laid up for a while.
The battle? It's over.
We counted 65 Cumberland bodies. Brother Sonril lost an eye, and 5 of Alhestian's men have gone to join the departed. Norta's eyes showed the same haunted look that had clouded them when he first killed a man during their hunt for Frentis. Unlike Canis and the others, Norta did not appear to be growing accustomed to killing. He gave a mirthless laugh.
A victory, brother.
Valin recalled the sound of the arrow as it flew past his ear and embedded itself in Lindon Alhestian.
A victory?
It feels like the worst of defeats.
Did he linger for long?
Norta frowned. Who?
Lord Alhestian. Did he suffer?
He suffers still, poor bastard. The arrow didn't kill him. Brother Mackerel doesn't know if he'll live. He's been asking for you.
Valin fought down a shudder of guilt-ridden despair.
Seeking a distraction, he moved to where Barkus was busily stripping the archer's corpse of any valuables.
Anything to say who he was?
Not much. Barkus quickly pocketed a few silver coins and extracted a sheaf of papers from the small leather satchel slung over the man's shoulder.
Found some letters. Might tell you something.
Norta took the papers, his eyebrows rising as he read the first few lines.
What is it?
Valin asked. Norta carefully folded the papers away. Something for the Aspect's eyes. But I think this little war of ours may be about to grow beyond this forest. Lord Lindon Alhestian lay on a bed of wolf fur, dragging air into his lungs with long, rasping breaths, his skin grey and moist with sweat. Brother Mackerel had extracted the arrow from his shoulder and dressed the wound with a herb poultice to draw out the poison. But this was only to ease the noble's mind. There was no saving him. They had forced red flower on him despite his objections, taking the edge from his pain, but he still suffered as the poison worked its way through his veins. The men had erected a tent for him, the stench inside stirring Valin's memory of his agonized recovery from the Joffrel route.
My lord, Valin said, sitting down next to him.
Brother. There was a ghost of a smile on the young noble's pale lips. They told me you went after Black Arrow. Did you get him?
He's with his god now,
Valin replied, though in truth he still didn't know for certain who the man had been.
Then we can go home, eh?
I think the king will be satisfied, don't you?
Valin looked into Alhestian's eyes, seeing the pain and the fear there, the knowledge that there would be no homecoming for him.
He would soon be gone from this world.
He will be satisfied.
Alhestian slumped back into the furs.
They killed the boy, you know.
I told them to leave him be, but they cut him to pieces. He didn't even cry out.
The men were angry.
They respect you greatly, as do I. To think my father warned me against you.
My lord?
My father and I have many differences, many arguments. Truth to tell, I confess I like him not, father or no. Sometimes I think he hates me for not matching his ambition with my own. And men of ambition see enemies everywhere, especially at court, where intrigue abounds. Before I left, he warned me of rumors, tales of a hidden hand moving against me, although he refrained from telling me whose hand. But he said I should mind you well. Rumors of a hidden hand? The princess has been busy, it seems. Why you would seek to hurt me, I cannot imagine, Al Hestian went on in his pained rasp. You'll tell him from me, won't you? You'll tell him we were friends. You'll tell him yourself. Al Hestian's laugh was faint. Humor me not, brother. There is a letter in my tent, back at the camp. I wrote it before we left. I would be grateful if you would see to its delivery. It's for a lady of my acquaintance.
A lady, my lord?
Yes. Princess Lena. He paused, sighing in sorrow. Coming here was to be the means by which I would finally win the king's favor. Our union would have had his blessing. Balin gritted his teeth to forestall the curse at his own stupidity. He had known since meeting Al Hestian that the king's description of him had been fanciful at best, but hadn't realized the true reason for his mission here. He was to rid the princess of an unsuitable match. The princess must have regretted seeing you ride into danger, he said. She is a lady of great fortitude. She said love must risk all or perish. I have much to do, and I will tolerate no obstacle. Balin felt a wave of self-loathing course through him. Princess, between us we have killed a very good man. I have a younger brother, Alusius, Al Hestian was saying. I would like him to have my sword. Tell him it would be best if he leaves it sheathed. I find war is not much to my liking. He paused, face tensing as a tremor of pain swept through him. Lerna, don't tell her it was like this. He choked off, convulsed in pain, blood staining his chin. Balin reached for him, but could only watch helplessly as Al Hestian writhed in his furs. Unable to bear it, he fled the tent, finding Brother Mackerel by the fire, his flask in hand, gulping brother's friend. Is there no hope? Balin pleaded. Nothing you can do? Mackerel barely glanced at him. He's had all the red flower we can give him. If we move him, he dies. A healer from the Fifth Order could ease his passing, but even they couldn't halt it. Balin winced as a shout of pain came from the tent behind him. Here. Mackerel held out his flask. It'll dull your hearing. We can't leave him to suffer like this. Mackerel looked up, meeting his eyes. The suspicion was still there, his instinctive knowledge of Valen's guilt. After a moment he looked away and started to rise. I'll take care of it. No. Valen turned back to the tent. No. It's my duty. The jugular. It's the quickest way. I doubt he'll even feel the cut. He nodded, walking back to the tent on numb legs. So the king has made me a murderer after all. Al Hestian's eyes were glazed and unfocused, as Valen knelt beside him, only coming back to life when they caught the glimmer of the dagger's blade. There was a moment of fear, then a sigh, whether of sorrow or relief Valen would never know. He met Valen's eye, smiled and nodded. Valen held him, cradling his head in his arm, laying the blade against his neck. Al Hestian spoke, forcing the words out through a fresh grimace of pain. I'm glad it was you, brother. Chapter 3. And these letters were found on the body of this black arrow? The Aspect's hands were splayed on the letters before him, like two pale spiders, his long face intent as he stared up at Valen and Mackerel. Valen supposed they must look dreadful, grimy and worn from the 12-day trek back from the Martish, but the Aspect seemed indifferent to their appearance. After listening to their report, he demanded the letters, his eyes scanning them quickly. We believe the man may have been Black Arrow, Aspect, Valen replied. There's no way to know for sure. Yes. Perhaps you shouldn't be so quick with the killing blow next time, brother. I was remiss. My apologies, Aspect. The Aspect dismissed the admission with a barely perceptible shake of his head. You understand the import of these letters? Sendell read them to us, Mackerel said. Did anyone outside the Order hear him?
We gave our Hestian's men a double rum ration that night. I doubt they could hear anything.
Good.
Pass the word to your brothers. They are not to discuss this with anyone, including each other. He gathered the letters together and placed them in a solid wooden chest on his desk, shutting it firmly and securing a heavy lock on the latch.
You must be tired, brothers. On behalf of the Order, I thank you for your service in the Martish.
Brother Mackerel, you're confirmed as a brother commander. You will reside with us here for the time being. Master Solis is currently commanding a company on the southern shore. The local smugglers are becoming excessively violent in resisting the king's excisemen. You will take over his lessons. You still remember enough of the sword to teach it, I'm sure.
Of course, Aspect.
Brother Valin, report to the stables at the 8th hour on the morrow. You will accompany me to the palace.
Congratulations, brother,
Valin offered as they made their way towards the practice ground, where Alhestian's regiment was encamped. There were no barracks available for them, so the Aspect had granted permission to remain at the Order House. Valin suspected no provision had been made for them in the city, because the king hadn't expected any to return. Mackerel paused, regarding him with silent scrutiny.
A commander and a master,
Valin went on, discomfited by the tracker's silence.
An impressive achievement.
Mackerel stepped close to him, his nostrils flared, drawing the air in. Valin resisted the impulse to reach for his hunting knife.
Never did like your scent, brother,
Mackerel said.
Something not quite natural about it. And now you stink of guilt.
Why is that? Without waiting for a reply, he turned and walked off, a stocky figure in the gloom. He gave a brief, shrill whistle, and his hound emerged from the shadows to pad alongside as he made his way to the keep. The tower room Valin had shared with the others for so many years was now occupied by a fresh group of students, so they had been obliged to camp with the regiment. He found his brothers clustered around the fire, regaling Frentis with tales of their time in the Martish.
"Went straight through two men," Dentos was saying. "A single arrow, a swear. Never seen nothing like it."
Valin took a seat next to Frentis. Scratch, who had been curled up at Frentis's feet, rose and came to him, nuzzling his hand in search of petting. Valin scratched his ears, realizing he had missed the slave hound greatly, but had no regrets about leaving him behind. The Martish would have been a fine playground for him, but Valin felt he had tasted enough human blood already.
"The Aspect thanks us for our service," he told them, stretching his hands out to the fire.
"The letters we found are not to be discussed."
"What letters?"
Frentis asked. Barkus threw a half-eaten chicken leg at him.
"Did he say where we're going next?" Dentos asked, passing him a cup of wine.
Valin shook his head.
"I'm to accompany him to the palace tomorrow."
Norta snorted and gulped a mouthful of wine.
"You don't need the dark to see the future for us."
His words were loud and slurred, chin stained red with spilled drink.
"On to Cumbrail!"
He got to his feet, raising his cup to the air.
"First the forest, then the fief! We'll bring the faith to them all, the denier bastards, whether they like it or not."
"Norta." Canis reached up to pull him down, but Norta shrugged him off.
"It's not as if we've slaughtered enough Cumbrailians already, is it? Only killed 10 of them myself in that bloody forest. How about you, brother?"
He swayed towards Canis.
"Bet you can beat that, eh? At least twice as many, I'd say."
He swung towards Frentis.
"Should have been them, my boy. We bathed in more blood than your friend One-Eye ever did."
Frentis's face darkened, and Valin gripped his shoulder as he tensed.
"Have another drink, brother," he told Norta. "It'll help you sleep."
"Sleep?" Norta slumped back to the ground.
"Haven't done much of that recently."
He held up his cup for Kenis to pour more wine, staring morosely into the fire. They sat in uncomfortable silence for a while, Valin grateful for the distraction provided by one of the soldiers at a neighboring fire. The man had found a mandolin somewhere, probably looted from a Cumbrailian corpse in the forest, and played it with considerable skill, the tune melodious but somber, the whole camp falling quiet to listen. Soon the player had an audience clustered around him, and began to sing a tune Velin recognized as the Warrior's Lament.
A warrior's song is a lonely tune, full of fire and gone too soon. Warriors sing of fallen friends, lost battles, and bloody ends.
The men applauded loudly when he finished, calling for more. Velin made his way through the small crowd. The player was a thin-faced man of about 20 years. Velin recognized him as one of the 30 chosen men who had taken part in their final battle in the forest, the stitched cut on his forehead testifying that he had done some fighting. Velin struggled to remember his name, but realized with shame that he hadn't bothered to learn the names of any of the men they had trained. Perhaps, like the king, he hadn't expected any to live.
"You play very well," he said.
The man gave a nervous smile. The soldiers had never lost their fear of Velin, and few made any effort to speak to him, most taking care to avoid catching his eye.
"I was apprenticed to a minstrel, brother," the man said.
His accent differed from that of his comrades, the words precisely spoken, the tone almost cultured.
"Then why are you a soldier?"
The man shrugged. "My master had a daughter." The gathered men laughed knowingly.
"I think he taught you well in any case," Velin said. "What's your name?"
"General, brother. General Norrin." Velin spied Sergeant Krelnik in the crowd.
"Wine for these men, Sergeant. Brother Francis will take you to Master Greenin in the vaults. Tell him I'll meet the expense. I'll make sure he gives you the good stuff."
There was an appreciative murmur from the men. Velin fished in his purse and dropped a few silvers into General's hand.
"Keep playing, General Norrin. Something lively. Something fit for a celebration."
General frowned. "What are we celebrating, brother?"
Velin clapped him on the shoulder. "Being alive, man."
He raised his cup, turning to the assembled men.
"Let's drink to being alive!"
The king convened his council of ministers in a large chamber, with a polished marble floor and ornate ceiling decorations in gold leaf and intricately molded plaster. The walls adorned with fine paintings and tapestries. Immaculately turned out soldiers of the royal guard stood to attention in a wide circle around the long, rectangular table where the council sat. King Janus himself was markedly different from the ink-spattered old man with whom Velin had made his bargain. Seated at the center of the table, an ermine-lined cloak about his shoulders and a band of gold on his brow. His ministers were seated on either side, 10 men dressed in varying degrees of finery, all staring intently at Velin as he finished his report, with Aspect Arlin at his side. At a smaller table nearby, 2 scribes sat writing down every word spoken. The king insisted on a precise recording of every meeting, and each council member had been required to state his name and appointed role before sitting down.
"And the man who carried these letters," the king said, "his identity remains unknown?"
"There were no captives to name him, Highness," Velin replied. "Black Arrow's men were not given to surrender."
"Lord Almona."
The king handed the letters to a portly man on his left, who had stated his name and office as Lartek Almolnar, Minister of Finance.
"You know Fief Lord Muster's hand as well as I. Do you see a similarity?"
Lord Almolnar examined the letters closely for a few moments.
"Regretfully, Highness, the hand that penned these missives seems so similar to the Fief Lord's that I can discern no difference between the two. More than that, the way the letter is phrased, even without a signature, I would know it as the work of Lord Muster."
"But why?"
asked Fleet Lord Aljunrel, a large bearded man on the king's right.
"Faith knows I have scant love for the Fief Lord of Cumbriel, but the man's no fool. Why sign his name to letters of free passage for a fanatic intent on fracturing our realm?"
"Brother Velin," Lord Almona said, "you fought these heretics for several months. Would you say they were well fed?"
"They did not seem weakened by hunger, my lord."
"And their weapons? Of good quality, would you say?"
"They had finely crafted bows and well-tempered steel, although some of their weapons were taken from our fallen soldiers."
"So, well-equipped and well-fed. And this in the dead of winter, when game would be scarce in the Martish. I submit, Highness, that this Black Arrow must have had considerable support."
"And now we know from where,"
said a third minister, Keldon Altelnar. Minister of Royal Works, and, next to the King, the most finely dressed man at the table.
Fief Lord Muster has condemned himself. Long have I warned that his observance of the peace was but a mask for future treachery. Let us not forget that the Cumbrelins were forced into this realm only after the bloodiest of defeats. They have never stopped hating us, or our beloved faith. Now the departed have guided brave Brother Valin to the truth. Highness, I implore you to act.
The King raised a hand, silencing the man.
Lord Al-General,
he turned to a grey-bearded man seated at his right hand. You are my Lord of Justice and Chief Judge of my courts, and perhaps the wisest head at this council. Are these papers evidence enough for trial or merely investigation?
The Lord of Justice stroked his silver-grey beard thoughtfully. If we consider this as only a matter of law, Highness, I would say the letters require question, and any charges would depend on the answers. If a man came before me charged with treason based solely on this evidence, I could not send him to the gallows.
Lord Altelnar started to speak again, but the King waved him to silence.
What questions, my lord?
Lord Al-General took up the letters and scanned them briefly.
I note that these letters grant the bearer free passage across the borders of Cumbriel, and require any soldier or official of the fief to render whatever assistance the bearer may require.
And indeed, if the signature and seal are genuine, they have been signed by the fief lord himself. But they are not addressed to any individual. Indeed, we do not even know the name of the man who carried them to his death.
If they were penned by the fief lord, did he intend them for use by Black Arrow, or were they perhaps stolen and used for a different purpose?
So then, Lord Al-Molnar said, you would have us put the fief lord to the question?
The chief judge took several seconds to reply, and Valin could see from the tension in his face that he recognized the grave import of his words.
I believe question is warranted, yes.
The door to the chamber opened abruptly, and Captain Smolin entered, coming to attention before the King and saluting smartly.
Found him, have you? The King asked.
I have, Highness.
Whorehouse or Redflower Palace?
Captain Smolin's only sign of discomfort was to blink twice.
The former, Highness. Is he in a fit state to talk?
He has made efforts to sober himself, Highness.
The King sighed and rubbed his forehead wearily.
Very well. Bring him in.
Captain Smolin saluted and strode from the room, returning a few seconds later with a man dressed in expensive but soiled clothes. He walked with the precise gait of one who worries he might tip over at any moment. The redness of his eyes and sallowness of his stubbled complexion bespoke several hours of excess. He looked to be in his 40s, but Valin guessed him to be younger, a man aged by indulgence. He halted next to Aspect Arlin, greeted him with a cursory nod, then bowed extravagantly but unsteadily to the King.
Highness, as ever I am honored by your summons.
Valin noted the man's accent.
Cumbrelin.
The King turned to his scribes.
Let the record show that His Honor, Lord Sentis Muster, heir to the fiefdom of Cumbriel, and appointed representative of Cumbrelian interests to the court of King Janus, is now in attendance.
He turned a level gaze on the Cumbrelian.
Lord Muster, and how are you this morning?
Lord Altelnar gave a muted snort of amusement.
Very well, Highness, Lord Muster replied. Your city has always been very kind to me.
I am glad.
Aspect Arlin you know, of course. This young man is Brother Valin Al-Sorna, recently returned from the Martish Forest.
Lord Muster's gaze was guarded as he turned to Valin, nodding a formal greeting, but his tone remained cheerful if forced.
Ah, the blade that won me 10 golds at the test of the sword. Well met, young sir.
Valin nodded back but said nothing. Mention of the test of the sword tended to darken his mood.
Brother Valin has brought us some documents.
The King took the letters from Lord Al-General.
Documents that raise questions. I believe your opinion of their content would be valuable in discerning their intent.
Valin took note of Lord Muster's momentary hesitation before stepping forward to take the papers from the King's hand.
These are letters of free passage, he said after scanning the pages.
and they are signed by your father, are they not? The king asked.
That would appear to be the case, Highness.
Then perhaps you can explain how Brother Valen came to find them on the body of a Cumbrelian heretic in the Martish forest.
Lord Muster's gaze swung to Valen, his reddened eyes suddenly fearful, then back to the king.
Highness, my father would never place documents of such import in the hands of a rebel. I can only imagine they were stolen somehow, or perhaps forged. Perhaps your father could provide a more absolute explanation.
I have no doubt he could, Highness.
If you would care to write to him,
I would not. He will come here.
Lord Muster took an involuntary step backwards, fear now obvious in his face. Valen could tell the situation dwarfed him. He was being tested and found wanting.
Highness, he stammered. My father, it is not right.
The king let out a long sigh of exasperation.
Lord Muster, I fought two wars against your grandfather, and found him an enemy of considerable courage and cunning. I never liked him, but I did respect him greatly, and I feel he would be grateful he is no longer here to see his grandson gabble like the whoring drunkard he is when his fief stands on the brink of war.
The king raised a hand to beckon Captain Smolin over.
Lord Muster will be our guest in the palace until further notice, the king told him. Please escort him to suitable quarters, and ensure he is untroubled by unwanted visitors.
You know that my father will not come here, Lord Muster stated flatly. He will not be put to the question. Imprison me here if you must, but it will make no difference. A man doesn't place his favored son in the hands of his enemy.
The king paused, regarding the Cumbrelian lord with a narrow gaze.
Surprised you, Valen realized. Didn't think he had the stomach to speak up.
We'll see what your father does, the king said.
He nodded to Captain Smolin, and Lord Muster was led from the room, two guards following close behind. The king turned to one of his scribes.
Draft a letter to the fief lord of Cumbriel, commanding his presence here within 3 weeks.
He pushed his chair back and got to his feet.
This meeting is over. Aspect Arlen, Brother Valen, please join me in my rooms.
Everything in the king's quarters gave an overwhelming impression of order, from the angle of the finely woven carpets on the tiled marble floor to the papers on the large oaken desk. Valen found nothing to compare to the cramped, hidden room of books and scrolls he had been led to 8 months before. That was where he worked, he realized. This is where he wants people to think he works.
Sit, please, brothers.
The king gestured at two chairs as he settled behind his desk. I can send for refreshments if you wish.
We are content, Highness,
Aspect Arlen replied in a neutral tone. He remained standing, obliging Valen to follow suit. The king's gaze lingered on the aspect for a moment, before he turned to Valen, his lips forming a smile beneath his beard. Note the tone, my boy. No respect, but no defiance either. You do well to learn it. I suspect your aspect is angry with me.
Why can that be, I wonder?
Valen looked at the aspect, who stood expressionless, offering no reply.
Well, the king pressed. Tell me, brother, what could have aroused the anger of your aspect?
I cannot speak for my aspect, Highness.
The aspect speaks for me.
The king snorted a laugh and smacked his palm on the desk.
You hear it, Arlen? His mother's voice. Clear as a bell. Don't you find it chilling at times?
Aspect Arlen's tone was unchanged.
No, Highness.
No.
The king shook his head, chuckling slightly and reaching for a wine decanter on his desk.
No, I don't suppose you do.
He poured himself a glass of wine and settled back into his chair.
Your aspect, he told Valen, is angry because he believes I have set the realm on the road to war. He believes, with some justification I might add, that the fief lord of Cumbriel will happily let me hack his drunken son's head from his shoulders before setting foot outside his own borders. This in turn will force me to send the realm guard into his fief to root him out.
Battles and bloodshed will result, towns and cities will burn, many will die.
Despite his vocation as a warrior,
and therefore a practitioner of death in all its many forms, the Aspect believes this to be a regrettable action. And yet he will not tell me so.
It has always been his way.
Silence reigned as the two men matched stares, and Valen experienced a sudden revelation. They hate each other. The King and the Aspect of the Sixth Order detest the sight of one another.
Tell me, brother, the King went on, addressing Valen but keeping his eyes on the Aspect.
What do you think the Fief Lord will do when he hears I have taken his son and commanded his presence?
I do not know the man, Highness.
He's not a complicated fellow, Valen. Reckon it out.
I dare say you've enough of your mother's wit for that. Valen found himself disliking the way the King's tongue twisted around the mention of his mother, but forced out a reply.
He will be angry. He will see your action as a threat. He will be put on guard, gathering his forces and watching his borders.
Good. What else will he do?
It seems he has but two choices, to follow your command, or ignore it and face war.
Wrong. He has a third choice. He can attack, with all his might.
Do you think he will do that?
I doubt Cumbriel would have the strength to face the Realm Guard, Highness.
And you would be correct.
Cumbriel has no actual army beyond a few hundred guardsmen loyal to the Fief Lord.
What it does have is thousands of peasant bowmen it can call upon in time of need. A formidable force. Having ridden through an arrow storm or two in my time, I would know. But no cavalry, no heavy infantry, no chance, in fact, of attacking Azrael or matching the Realm Guard in open field.
The Fief Lord of Cumbriel is far from being an admirable character, but he does have enough of his father's brains to heed a reminder of his weakness.
The King smiled again, turning away from the Aspect and waving a hand in placation.
Oh, don't worry, Arlin.
In a fortnight or so, the Fief Lord will send his messenger with a suitably grovelling apology for not attending in person, and a plausible, if not very convincing, explanation for the letters, probably attached to a chest full of gold.
I will be persuaded by my wise and peace-loving son to withdraw my command and release the drunkard.
Thereafter, I doubt the Fief Lord will be giving any more letters of free passage to deny fanatics.
More importantly, he'll have remembered his place in this realm.
Am I to take it, Highness, the Aspect said,
that you are convinced the Fief Lord is the author of the letters?
Convinced?
No.
But it seems likely.
The man may not be a fanatic like the fool's brother Valen dispatched in the Martish, but he does have a weakness for his god. Probably fretting over his place in the Eternal Fields now he's past his 50th year. In any case, whether he wrote the letters or not makes little difference. The problem lies in the mere fact of their existence. Once they came to light, I had little choice but to act.
At least this way, the Fief Lord will feel a debt to my son when he ascends the throne.
The King quickly downed the rest of his wine and rose from his desk.
Enough, statecraft. I have other business with you, brothers. Come.
He beckoned them into a smaller adjoining room, no less ornately decorated. But in place of paintings or tapestries, the walls were adorned with swords, 100 or more gleaming blades.
A few were of the Azraelin pattern, but there were many others the style of which Valen had never seen. Great two-handed broadswords nearly 6 feet in length, sickle-like sabers with blades that curved almost in a semicircle, long needle-like rapiers with no edge and bowl-shaped guards, swords with blades fashioned of gold or silver, despite the fact that such metals were too soft to ever make useful weapons.
"Pretty, aren't they?" the King commented. "Been collecting them for years. Some are gifts, some are the spoils of war. Some I bought simply because I like the look of them. Every so often I give one away." He turned to Valen, smiling again. "To a young man like you, brother."